You know, so many of these stories in the exhibit are based on identity. You know, how we see ourselves and how we see other people, maybe how other people see us or even how we think they see us. You know, there's a difference between how we think we're perceived and how other people see us, and this makes relationships really complex sometimes. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, and I want to start out with this exercise, this worksheet that you have to explore our own identities. You know, I am from, this is a question we ask ourselves when we bump into new people at Holden, right? Where are you from? And almost always, well, half of the time, the answer is from Minnesota, it seems. The other half is evenly split from somewhere in Washington and every other state in the union. But there are, so geography is kind of our go-to. I am from this place, Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. Now I live in the Twin Cities. But there's so many other ways that we can answer that question and tell that story. For myself, you know, I could say I'm from a family that values stability and security, yet I've chosen a career path that has none. you know, we could say I'm from the city, but my heart is here in the mountains. I could say I'm from a straight, white, Christian background that values diversity. So there's all sorts of ways that we can tell this story about where we're from and who we are. And these are some of the issues that I address as we're interviewing these different people. The first question I ask is, tell me who you are. If I didn't know anything about you, what do you want me to know? Not what does everybody else think about you, but what do you want me to know about you? How do you see yourself? And so I want to ask you to take a few minutes. We've got prompts on that worksheet. You know, what's your gender? What's your religion? What's your economic status? There are all sorts of different ways, and those are just suggestions. You can answer. So the bottom one is blank. I am from. You can answer that however you want. But I want you to be bold, and I want you to be creative and thoughtful about how you respond to those prompts and how you see yourself. And we'll just take 3 or 4 minutes. I'll set a little alarm here if you need a couple more minutes after that. Yeah. Gender. I'm from a straight cis male perspective. You know, I think, especially I think in younger generations, this notion of gender is a little more fluid. And that's really important to some people to be seen in a different way. You know, in a lot of the colleges I work at, with this project, on people's name tags, they will put the pronouns they want to be referred to as, you know, him, his, he, him, his, she, her, hers, them, they, theirs. So I think, you know, that kind of thing. And it may be a traditional understanding of that as you answer it, and it may be something else, and that's okay too. But that's what that is referring to. Any other questions? Otherwise, I'll see if I can learn how to do my timer. And give you 3 or 4 minutes. If we get to the end of that and you need more time, just let me know. Yeah, I mean, we won't hold you accountable. Go through as many as you can. And if there's something that just doesn't make sense to you and it's irrelevant, just leave that one blank and move on. Well, that's about 3.5 minutes. How you doing? You need another minute to wrap up? Yeah, okay. Or more? Oh, right, you get an extension. I tell you, Holden is like a presenter's dream. Everybody is studious and paying attention and doing stuff. That's great. Not always the case with middle school students. So for those of you who are still working, that's okay. Keep working a little bit. For those of you who are kind of done, timer done. I have to set the timer because otherwise it seems like 3 minutes standing up here by myself quiet seems like an eternity. If you've finished, or as you finish, I want you to think about the way you described those identities, the way you described yourself, and just run down the left-hand side of that paper. And if it's a positive sense, that identity, put a little plus sign. If there's some negative connotation or some struggle you've had with that in your life, just put a little minus sign on that. So just run down to the bottom. We'll give you a couple more minutes. And if you don't get them all filled out, that's all right. We're getting close to good enough. almost. You don't have to raise your hand. You don't have to tell me the answer. But I want you to think about that list of pluses and minuses. And is the balance more pluses or is the balance more minuses? If you want to share, who feels like they've got more pluses on their page, then okay. You realize what a privilege that is, that we've got that. I go into schools all the time, and that's not the case. You know, there are lots of kids growing up with a long list of minuses on there, and they recognize it. It's not just that we can see it from the outside, but they recognize it. They know how things are stacked for them. I was with a bunch of fifth graders, and I did this little exercise where I asked them to write a word in the middle of the page, something that was unpeaceful for them. And then around it, they would write some qualifiers, and they would explain why that's unpeaceful. And then around the outside perimeter, they would write what they could do to change that, how they could make it better. I'm an optimist, right? This one little girl, fifth grade, raised her hand and said, I can't think of anything positive to write. And I thought, well, there's always something. Let me take a look at your paper. And in the middle, she had written the word police. I thought, really? That's not how I grew up. And so I looked at how she had written the descriptors around it, and she said, well, they always come to my house late at night, and there's always yelling and screaming, and then somebody always gets taken away, and there's always guns. And I thought, good Lord, how do I tell her how to change that? You know, and so it helps reveal the bubble that I've lived in my entire life. It helps me recognize how differently some other people grow up. And the second thing that occurred to me is, you know, it'd be great to say to her parents, come on, parents, step up and do a little better. But sometimes that's not going to happen in the world. And so the question as a society is, what do? We just going to let her struggle and fall down and pay the price later on? Or is there something we can do to help move that along so that she can become a productive member of society, even if she doesn't have the role models she should? If there are negatives, well, if there are positives, bless you. I want you to think about how they have formed you, how they have shaped who you are. And I'd like to ask you to share one of those if you feel like it. Anybody brave got an identity there that they can sort of tie to an early experience that you'd like to share? Yeah. Can you go a little louder so we can all hear? 16 out of 16. Well, and where the resistance, where the pushback happens is when people say, well, I had to work hard to get where I got. Well, nobody's denying that. And somebody might say, well, I've had some struggles in my life. Nobody's denying that. But you've got a certain set of circumstances that have smoothed the way a little bit. You know, and so, let's see, I'm white, I'm middle-aged, I'm middle-class, I've got a college education, I was raised by an intact household, I'm still married to the same person, you know, I know that I'm going to eat every day, sometimes more than I should, right? All of those things. I was just reading a book with statistics. If there are 100 people in the entire world, 80 of them can't read or write, you know, 75 of them don't have secure housing. Right. One of them has a college degree. And so I've said this to my kids over the years, you know, if they're struggling or having trouble feeling that they're not quite doing what they should do, I'm like, okay, well, you're living in one of the most comfortable nations in the world. Within that nation, you're living in one of the states that's doing pretty well, by most of the statistics. Within the state, you're living in a pretty affluent neighborhood. Within the neighborhood, not everybody has that. Yeah. What else? Anything else? There could be somebody who's not from a straight background who might call it a minus, not because they're uncomfortable with where they are, but because they're uncomfortable with how they've been treated because of that. But I think it's true. A lot of these things are not all good or all bad. They're a mix, or they're just a thing. You know, we talk about that all the time, about, you know, this is not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing. So, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, one of my primary engagement places where I go is colleges. And so a lot of times with young 20s, sort of that 25 to 35 range, I don't even know where to find them sometimes. You know, there's not the institutional presence. And when I do it at churches, we wind up dealing more with people my age and a little bit older. And so, you know, haven't had a great experience specifically with that demographic. But yeah, certainly college age students, seminarians in, you know, with advanced degrees are a little older. Oh, they see the world more negatively. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. Anybody else have that perspective? Or want to refute that? Kindly? I mean, this is about peace, right? Okay, so he was saying that demographic, maybe mid-20s, mid-30s, thereabout, that they perhaps see the world with a little more pessimism, a little more negativity. Am I getting that right? They see the future in a less positive way. Is that something you've seen in that generation as well? Who says yes? Who wants to refute that? You had your hand up for both. Right, those are very different experiences and are going to color how you see the world. I think, I don't know. I think, and you can argue with me on this point, I think perhaps the world feels more complex today than it did when I was growing up, than it did when you were growing up. I think that a lot of these things on the list of identities are things that we may not have even talked about. We didn't even talk about what gender are you, right? That's just a thing. But these are things that are in the consciousness. And so I feel in some ways like this generation has a lot more that they're talking about. And there I think, can be some uncertainty around that. These are paths that are not necessarily charted because we just sort of pushed them aside before. And so it's an interesting difference. Deb? Sure. The trajectory was that you're going to do as good as your parents or better than your parents. And that was, that lasted for a long time. This is the first generation where that's shifting. And I think, you know, you look at developing nations, you look at parts of the world where there's not, an enormous amount of potential. And there I think is an oppressive, pessimism there. That no matter how hard you try, there's nowhere you can go. And I think that can be really paralyzing. I think that it can stunt innovation, it can stunt ambition if you feel like you're never going to get anywhere anyway. And so I think this is the thing that this generation's dealing with in a way that we never had to. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think overall there's a larger awareness of social structures and influences that perhaps I was oblivious to as a youngster. Back here, and then I'll come to you. And what's our human nature? I mean, we come home and we're happy to talk about the person who cut us off and the guy who was a jerk to us today. And it's really easy to focus on those things. But even if 5 horrible things happen to us and 20 decent or neutral things happen to us, we go to the negative. And so when there's that onslaught of negativity that comes through the media, I think that enhances our predisposed nature to focus on that. And I think we have to be really intentional to break out of that cycle. Yeah. I would, and this is not a sales pitch because you can read all of these stories on my website, I would challenge you to spend 10 minutes a day listening to the audio of these people talking, these people who have found positive ways to engage with the world. Listen to one of those every day for 50 days. See if you notice a switch in your perspective as opposed to feeding yourself a news stream or something negative. You had something to say, and then I'll come back here. And let me ask you this. Did you have any small sense that perhaps you could make a difference and that you could shift any of those things? Do you think? Yeah, and I think that might be what's different, is this sense that the problems are so big and I'm so small that there's no way that, you know, these processes and these institutions are so big that maybe I can't make a difference. I don't think that's true, but I think that could be a perception. Oh, so many hands. You know we're never going to get through any of this other stuff, but this is good. Yeah. I'm not sure that we're designed to be able to fully process and grapple with this civil war over here and that problem in Sudan and these floods over here. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be aware of them and that we shouldn't do what we can to respond, but I'm not sure as human beings that we were built to process all of that. You know, I think it becomes overwhelming in a hurry, not to mention, oh my gosh, what are we going to make for dinner tonight? Or, you know, this broke at home and I've got to get it fixed. It's busy. Yeah. And you are on to the wee bit of hope that I see and I want to talk about. Did you have something you wanted to add? Right. And there's beauty in being able to move wherever you want and do whatever you want, but there's a price. Interesting. Yeah, one more, and then I want to come back to that idea. Oh, okay, two more. I'm really bad at saying no. Oh, yeah. Did everyone hear that? Oh, should I say it with the microphone? Yes. No, sorry. A saying in the Navy that one oh shit wipes out a whole bunch of attaboys. You know, and in my career as a freelance photographer, not unlike that is you're only as good as your last job. You can shoot 20 great projects and then you blow it and they're never going to call you back again. So, yeah, I think we there's not a lot of grace sometimes for when there are problems. All right. Yeah, there's signs of renewed activism. There is, there's acknowledgement that we can create change. We make enough noise and something will happen. I mean, that's the history of the world, and it happened with the women's movement, and it happened with emancipation of the slaves, and it happened with the civil rights movement. There's a lot of examples of when people sort of rising up and making their voice heard have changed policy, that leaders can only tolerate so much pressure before they're going to respond. And I heard, I'm not a statistics person, but I think I remember hearing that really only 10% of Americans were active in the civil rights movement. You know, this was not 90 or 100% of our country. This is 10% of vocal people that captures the public imagination. And of course, we have opportunities when the status quo will try to resist that by calling them, you know, malcontents and losers and lazy people and why aren't they out working. But I think, you know, we have a long history of public activism changing policy. So we all know what some of the problems are, but as John George said, so what's the solution? I think what I see when you're talking minimalism, I will tell you I'm a big fan of beer. You'll see where this is related. Yes, other fans in the audience, good. You'll see where this is related. So there was a time when the beer market was dominated by Miller and Bud and these mega corporations. And then there started being a little interest for something new, something smaller, something handcrafted so that it was unique and it had a little bit of difference to it. And now that's exploding, right? People are willing to pay a little bit more for something that's unique. And my hope is that this entire movement, which is probably generations long towards materialism, that there can be a resistance to it. That's still going to be a large part of our community. It's going to be a large part of our culture, but that there will be resistance to that, that there will be alternatives to that, and people will recognize the value in other things. You know, not McDonald's, but maybe the slow food movement. Slow it down, be healthy, be, you know, these things are happening. And I think when I get frustrated with some of the big trends that I see, I also do take hope in seeing some of these little turns and people acknowledging that they don't have to swim down that same stream. We had a saying at our house, which is not polite, but since you broke the ice on that one, we would always refer to the masses, but because we have a Minnesota accent, it would come out as dumbasses. You know, you don't have to follow what everybody's doing. And I think this younger generation is finding that there are other ways to succeed, other ways to be, maybe out of necessity, because the old model doesn't work. Burn up stuff. Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, those are all good things. I want to talk a little bit about, over in Padraig's sessions, we're talking about borders and we're talking about migration and movement of people. And very much in this second book, I tried to come up with stories that could be relevant for the issues we're talking about today, that could sort of personify some of the social issues we're talking about in our country. And so I was really intentional, if we're talking about undocumented immigrants, that maybe we should also talk to undocumented immigrants. And so I found a couple of people, and I just want to share short excerpts from a couple of those stories. Two stories that are related to immigration and undocumented status, but stories that have very different experiences. And the first one is of Cesar, and I just want to read you a little bit of what he had to say. He said, when I think about peace, I think about being able to do... Okay, wait, I want to preface this. When he was a teenager, he lives in Riverside, California, or at least he did. I tried texting him about a year ago, and he didn't respond. So I don't honestly know what his situation is now. But he was born in Mexico, and he crossed the border on foot when he was 16. On the journey, he was robbed. He almost died of dehydration, and he was almost caught by Border Patrol twice. And although his mother and his sisters are U.S. citizens, because of the way he entered the country, he can never become documented under the current rules. And he said, when I think about peace, I think about being able to do what every other person does when they like go to school, go to work, pay their bills, and have a family. To me, that's peace. I know it's simple, but peace would be not having to watch my back or worry that I'll be pulled over and asked my status. I want to do what everyone else does without thinking I'm going to get deported and never see my family again. He says, Mexico is still a part of me, but it's no place that I want to be. Right now, I'm keeping myself busy. I fix cars. I work in construction and cleaning yards. I work in restaurants and places where I'm sure that they won't check my status. I just try to live a normal life, even though being deported is a constant fear. Every day when I'm out driving and I see a police car, it crosses my mind. I try to be a good citizen. I pay my taxes through an ITIN, which is what you use if you don't have a social, because I don't have a social. I try to go to school and live a normal American life. Every now and then I hang out with my friends, go out to eat, have a drink, talk to pretty girls, and just try to be normal. So that's Cesar's experience. When I interviewed him, he was still undocumented. He offered that I could use his full name. I chose not to. He talked about being nervous about being interviewed. Finding that sort of trust and being able to connect with someone and say, hey, can I photograph you and interview you and share this publicly? He felt that was important to try to help people understand what his situation is. And he was being bold, but I didn't want to be the person that got him picked up by ICE. So in the second person is Julissa Arce. And so she came to the U.S. when she was 11 years old on a visa. Her parents had work visas here. It was a 3-year visa. When she became 14, they overstayed their visa because her parents were working up here. She had no idea. She was 14 years old. It was only when she started applying for college that she realized she was undocumented. It was just not a thing they talked about. She just went to school and it was normal. And then she had to make a choice. She said, I had an offer to work full-time for Goldman Sachs. I'll tell you some of what led to that, but instead of being happy and excited about it, I was terrified. It was one thing to be an intern when she put herself through college and she had an internship at Goldman Sachs. And it was one thing to be an intern, lost my place, but it was a whole other thing to work there full time because I'd have to go through a background check. I would have to get trading licenses from government agencies. And I thought my only option is to call it a day, go back to Mexico and get a menial job. The other option is to break the law, get fake papers, and ride it as long as I can. She said, I chose option B. My employer never found out I was undocumented. No one ever questioned me. She said, if my English wasn't good, though, and if I was working as a waitress or a dishwasher at a restaurant, people would question me. But because I worked at Goldman Sachs and graduated cum laude from a top business school, nobody was ever going to think twice about me or question my credentials. She said, luckily, I was good at my job, built good relationships with my bosses, and I had a great mentor. I kept getting promoted and given more responsibility. A lot of people say, well, you should have gotten to the back of the line. And if there was a line, I would have been waiting there from the minute I became undocumented. But there isn't. She said she came there illegally. So by the time she recognized even what her situation was, there was no path for her to get documented. She eventually found a path. She was creative. She is now a U.S. citizen. She works on immigration rights and so forth. She eventually, she took that job at Goldman Sachs. She said every year the IRS sent her a little note that said, the Social Security number you're listing doesn't square up with any of our records. And she said she'd panic for a little bit and then put it in a drawer and never respond at all. And there was never any follow-up. So she eventually became the vice president of derivatives trading for Goldman Sachs on Wall Street while she was undocumented. I don't even know what that means. but anyway, yes. Yep. Yeah. And so when there is no legal path, when there is no route that you can take and you find yourself here where you've lived since the time you were 11, what are you going to do? Create a path. People to show kindness, people who understand how our system works. I mean, that's a pretty vulnerable place to be in. Ruth was in a pretty vulnerable place. And when you're at that place, it's hard to navigate the system a little bit. Hang on a sec. I have a whole list of questions. I mean, what are some of the conditions that drive migration? Crops. All right. War. Violence. Perception. Say more about that. Oh, right. We hear that all the time in the rhetoric. Well, sure. Yeah, they're taking our jobs. Of course, that's something that's said. However, my wife and I also run a Christmas tree farm and just met the biggest producer in the upper Midwest by Black River Falls and asked him about his work crew, because he sells 160,000 Christmas trees. And he says, we used to like to hire locally. He said, unfortunately, every day about 70 to 80% of those local people would show up for their jobs. And after payday and they went and got drunk at the bar, nobody would show up the next day. So now they're working through a legal process. Do you remember the H1B? They literally send a bus. They coordinate through the State Department or Commerce or whatever it is. They send a bus down to the border where they load up 80 people from Mexico and they bring them up. And you know what? They show up for work every day. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so are they taking our jobs or are they working the jobs that nobody else really wants? You know, we need the labor. We need that labor. And he says that he's required to give them good housing and pay them a fee. They can only work on his farm. He can't contract them out. And when they're done with their season, these 80 people, they've got 3 days to get back and across the border. And if they don't, they're kicked out of the program. But it's an important part of how we operate as a society, too. What would it take to force your hand? Have you ever felt pressure to move for any reason? Has there ever been something in your life that has forced you elsewhere? Been different. And so this leads up to one of my other questions. Have you ever been given a pass when others might not have? And she was given a pass because of who she was. And not only because of where she came from, the part of the world, and how she looked, and that it was easy to fit in, but also because you had the resources, you had the connection to a lawyer, you had somebody right there who could offer you guidance, and not everybody has that either. She didn't vote until she was 70. I bet. You said you've been within 25 miles of the same spot your whole life. So what would it take in your life to disrupt it enough to force you to move? What sort of, yes? Is that the blasphemous part? No, okay, I'm sorry, carry on. Well, and that's a really positive force, right? That's a positive force that's making you move. Yeah, what else? Oh yeah, you know what? You're better. You're way better. Okay, again, a positive force that would make you migrate. Okay, yeah. Yeah, sure. If it was unsafe, if there was danger to your kids, you'd do darn near anything, I suppose. Unless you didn't have the resources. Right. Here and then here. Yes. Yeah. If Cesar was told at 14 years old, you know what, you need to go by yourself across the border, how dire does that situation need to be for that to be the best option? Yeah. Could be ICE. Could be somebody else to take me away. Could be. Well, I am of the opinion that you can build as tall a wall as you want. You can put as big a fence as you want. And if people are desperate, they're going to find a creative way to come in. Most of them don't walk across the line. Most of them are on a work permit. They overstay a visa, any number of those things. Wall's not going to fix that. What if, in my mind, what's going to make them not want to migrate, what's going to keep communities intact is if conditions are better in their country. What if we take our eye off of one prize and we say, well, if we can strengthen the social fabric, if we can do something to support community and structure in these other places and development, people aren't going to just leave if things are going well in their place. You know, if there's something we can do to put a stopgap in what's happening in Syria, you're not going to have a flood of 1.5 million people coming out of Syria. And so I think that it's a short-sighted notion to wall ourselves in. I think it's ineffective. I want to share a story that I hope I can articulate well. I may or may not do a good job of it. I was bringing my exhibit down to Asheville, North Carolina. Apparently, there's only one gas pipeline that comes into Asheville because they're up in the mountains. And there'd been a disruption in that pipeline down in Arkansas or somewhere. And I drove in the way I always drive in with my truck, which is I look at the little number that says, you can go 8 more miles before you run out of gas. And I had to go set up my exhibit, which I knew. Okay, so it said I could go 20 more miles. And I knew my exhibit was just going to be 7 miles away. And I was running short on time. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go put up the exhibit. And then when everything's good, I'll come and gas up. When I came back to gas up, the gas station was closed. I'm like, that's weird. And then I went to another gas station. And the lights went blink. And they went out. And then I went to another gas station. And they had the little plastic out of order sleeves on every single pump. I'm like, what on earth is going on? And I talked, I banged on the little window and I said, is there no gas? Is it God's day today that we don't sell gas or what? And they said, we're out. That's it. And so I drove to the place where I was staying and I started getting a little panicked. I'm like, okay, I can go back and forth to the college 3 times before I'm out of gas. And I've got 4 days to go there. And started looking online, and there was a service that would say, you know, every morning a couple trucks would come into Asheville and you could get in line and you could get your gas. And the first morning I did that, and everybody in front of me got gas, including the man in front of me who filled up his gas tank and then 5 extra tanks to put in his trunk. And then as it was my turn, it was empty. And that was it. And I thought to myself, and I didn't run into any trouble. I didn't have any problems. But the next day, somebody was stabbed as they were trying to get gas and doing that same sort of thing. There was an altercation because people are like, I need gas. And it occurred to me how incredibly fragile our social fabric really is. That we wake up every morning and we think, oh, everything's going to go fine. And I'm going to go to work and then I can buy food and then I can get gas and then I can go out to eat at a restaurant. And everything rolls along just fine. But that one little snag, I mean, I wondered what would happen if that had gone on for a week, if that had gone on for 2 weeks. How uptight and concerned and desperate and self-serving would people become in a dire situation like that in this country where we have darn near everything? So this, whatever this social compact is that holds us together, I think can be frayed really easily if we're not careful. And I think we have to ask ourselves as we see all of the debate and all of the polarization and all the anger and frustration going on in our country, if we think about where that can lead, I think we want to ask ourselves carefully, what can we do to turn that around? What can we do to shift that and find the unity that we have again? Did you have your hand up? Yeah. Yeah, that was our first day there. And perhaps the proper response is, fear not. Huh? It's going to be okay. We can do this. We'll be okay. Yeah. Okay, one more, and then I'm afraid it's already 3 o'clock. How on earth did that happen? Well, okay, so she says she can see that kind of situation uniting us. I'll give out one more book recommendation, which is called Tribe, and it's written by Sebastian Junger, and he talks about, you know, that we in a modern society really don't have the social cohesion that a tribal structure has, that we don't have a sense of belonging. We no longer have that sense of common purpose. And the two places that he sees it still are in the military, right? That bond, that common purpose. and right after natural disasters. And all the social strata tend to break down so that we're all just people, and whatever class you're in, whatever race you're in, we're just all going to figure this out. And as soon as the immediate needs are met, we go right back to our division. So is there a way we can find that kind of social cohesion without A, war, or B, a natural disaster? Okay, I said one more, but how about one more? Yeah, that competitive individual look, I will, and I'm sorry that we don't have more time, but if you want to explore that idea, I would encourage you to read Sheila Goldtooth's story, and she's from the Navajo Nation, and she talks very much about how their culture approaches life differently. And not that we have to become Navajo and do it all that way, but perhaps there's a little something we could pick up that could be useful. I'm going to be up here if anyone wants to talk about more things, but our time is out. Thank you for coming.